So welcome back. So Ronald's going to be doing the next session.
Yes, and it's also the last session of
the last session. There we go, yes.
And let me put up the slides. This session is a small part about Active Directory, and then one big topic that we haven't addressed yet, and that is how to deal with the integration, or migration is a better word, for Hyper-V on-premise.
Okay, so if you have a you've been excited about this then.
Of
this
course, is yours. Everything okay. With Hyper-V. Azure is using Hyper-V, so I was happy all day. But,
yeah.
but if you have a virtual machine in Hyper-V at your corporate location and you want to move it or copy it to Windows Azure, then how can you go about doing that and how can you pull it down again? Right. This is also a great opportunity to showcase PowerShell with Windows Azure.
Oh, good.
So like you mentioned in the previous session, PowerShell can do everything that's in the portal and more.
And more, yes.
And now we're also addressing one of those and more aspects. So that's why we're using PowerShell there. So I'll show that. Okay. First, we'll look at Active Directory in a virtual machine. That's an interesting topic. And you could question, why are we even discussing this? Because there's so many things you can run inside a virtual machine.
Right.
But there's something special about Active Directory that makes it worthwhile to make sure that we do it correctly. This is part of a larger topic, you could say, how to virtualize domain controllers in any virtual machine, be it Hyper-V or Windows Azure. And there's actually a lot of information on the Microsoft website about what you have to pay attention to when you run a domain controller inside a virtual machine. And in fact, the latest versions of Active Directory have made it even easier to run inside a virtual machine. They have all kinds of protections against things that could go wrong if if the database is put back or if the database is copied or something like that. We're not addressing that, but we're now just looking specifically of what is in Windows Azure related to Active Directory. And I think the two aspects that are most important were already mentioned today, but I want to call them out anyway. If you bring your own DNS, like you said, and you run it inside a virtual machine, then the domain controller virtual machine would be a really good candidate, of course, to combine with DNS. But at the same time, we mentioned during the day that all the Azure virtual machines use DHCP, or in other words, get a dynamic IP address from the DHCP server.
They do, and doesn't that kind of go against then the whole DNS, domain controller idea that everyone must assign everything statically? That just is
I agree.
Great and topic there, yeah.
And even for servers, other servers than domain controllers, people already are a little bit uneasy about using DHCP for let's say, a file
because
server.
Because we're so used to doing it this other way, and we're like, okay, we're going to be sure that it's always going to stay the same, right? Yeah,
exactly.
And like, oh, no, trust. So, yeah.
And, oh, of course, the lease is for a long period. So you
really
can,
long, as you noticed, yeah.
Yeah, you know that you will keep it for a long time. And surprisingly, all these components, let's say the server, the domain controller, and even DNS, are totally happy with the fact that the IP address they find on the network adapter is assigned by DHCP. You would almost imagine that they would complain a little bit, like this is not a good practice. But everything works, and they are totally fine with that mechanism.
Well, in fact, yeah, it's a really bad idea to assign an IP address to a VM because it might look really good for a little while, and then all of a sudden you start moving things, and poof,
you lose. Oh, if you assign a static IP address.
Yeah, exactly. It looks like everything's all perfect, and then, bam, it's really not perfect. So you must always allow it to assign that DHCP IP address. You can't, like, fool it. You'd be like, oh, this is great. Boom. Yeah.
That's a good point. I actually should have added that to the slide, that the solution to this discussion is not to then go ahead and make a static IP address.
Yeah, don't get that DHCP IP address and then like put it in there because that would really not be a good
correct,
thing.
Correct, correct. Yeah. So you would have the DHCP assign an IP address to the domain controller and to the DNS server itself, and then everything works. So that's the first thing. There's not much to demonstrate there, but it just works.
Yeah.
And the second thing related to Active Directory has to do with the fact that you want to avoid that Active Directory databases either get corrupted or otherwise get inconsistent by the fact that there is disk caching, write caching, on the normal C drive.
Which is what you were talking about earlier, about the disk
exactly.
caching. And all. Okay, yeah.
So that's a
so
real
bringing it home. Yeah.
Example, if I switch back to the portal again, if these are not domain controllers, what I have here, but if you look at the disks, the normal C disk, no, mm-hmm. any C disk, if I look of normal virtual machine, you would see that the C disk, this is the disk C, mm-hmm. Where Windows is running,
is
read-write cache.
Wow.
And so one of the steps in setting up Active Directory would be to have a server like this. And then before you run DCPromo, or in the later versions of Windows, install the Active Directory role, before you do that, you would attach another disk. And one of the features of that disk would be it could even be an empty disk, doesn't matter, would be that you either use no caching or use read-only caching,
okay.
as long as you don't use read-write caching, because that's what you have to avoid.
Because that delay
there.
Is just not good,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Active Directory would not be able to handle that well in case something happens, in case the domain controller is moved or something like that. So you would add a disk, and then you would add the Active Directory role.
Okay.
And during the wizard, you would actually point to the location of the extra, let's say, E drive or F drive, for the location of the Active Directory database.
Gotcha.
So that it won't be on the C drive. And also not on the D drive, because that was a temporary drive, remember? So
that would be bad,
that
too.
That was the
right.
worst choice.
Good point,
so.
Yeah.
So there was a small part on about some aspects related to Active Directory in a virtual machine.
Right.
Many of the other aspects about virtualizing a domain controller mm-hmm. are the same if you run it on Hyper-V. So the white paper on the topic is very suitable still for
oh, good,
here.
Okay.
So
you direct people to go check out that white paper and check out
yes.
the documentation, because
yeah,
I know that they're constantly updating the stuff with that, yeah.
Well, but it has a good discussion on the difficulties or the risks of putting back a backup that is older and then rolling back the database
right.
and things like that. So
all
it's
right,
still
so,
good to
so
read.
Just don't just willy-nilly start creating stuff. Go look at it first.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Especially for a domain
controller, right.
Yes,
of course, that makes sense.
Unrelated to this,
okay.
let's also discuss migrating VHDs from Hyper-V on your corporate location to Azure.
Okay.
You can do that. We already discussed that VHDs are the same format, so that works. Now we just have to find out how we can get them there. And if you do that, if you move or copy VHD files from Hyper-V to Azure, you can basically do all kinds of disks. So it could be a Windows disk, a C drive, with Windows already installed.
Wow.
And then you load it, and then you can actually boot the virtual machine as a running copy of Windows. It could be a data disk. That's a very simple example, because then you don't have to do anything, just add the data disk. And you could even upload an image, which is, remember, a sysprepped
right.
version.
Okay.
So you don't have to prepare that all in Windows Azure. You can prepare it also
locally?
On the Hyper-V side, if
oh,
you have
okay.
more experience there, or already have done that, and then you can upload them.
Is there any pro or con of doing it either way? It's just whichever you're most comfortable with?
I think a combination of indeed what you're most comfortable with and maybe what you have already, because you can imagine that you have
right.
maybe a library of images already in Hyper-V before you start using Azure, and then you would just upload them
those.
And
okay.
define them as images.
Okay.
So.
Makes sense.
On the data disks, if you add them, whether they come from Hyper-V or not, it might be interesting to point out two numbers here, that each data disk on the blob stored can have a maximum of 1 terabyte, so that's pretty big. And you can have, depending a little bit on the virtual machine size, you can have up to 16 of those
wow.
data disks. So Mr. Scusi will be really busy if you have to
add
all
like
16
crazy. Right,
of them. So let's go into a little more detail on the VHD files. It stands for virtual hard disk, of course, comes from virtual PC, virtual server, and now Hyper-V. And over time, there has been a new version of the VHD format called VHDX. That's also the extension of it. And at this time, the Azure VHD files need to meet certain requirements. One of them is that they cannot, Azure cannot at this time yet, support a VHDX format, so it has to be a VHD file. That's not such a big deal because it's very easy. Actually, the screenshot is from there. In Hyper-V, you can easily convert without losing anything of the data. Mm-hmm. You can convert a VHDX file to VHD. So that's just a step you have to do. And then once it's a VHD file, you can upload it again. So that's just something that currently Azure does not support yet, even though Hyper-V has it.
Okay.
Another aspect is that the VHD files that you have on Hyper-V can be of two different types. You can have a fixed size, or you can have a dynamically expanding size type. And Azure requires it to be a fixed size VHD file. That is also something that can easily be converted without losing any data from dynamically expanding to fixed size. What is worth pointing out, though, that even the upload command that we'll use a little bit later does the conversion automatically, the conversion to fixed size. So if you never knew this was the case, you would not even notice it because it just converts it on the fly when it uploads it. Before we look at it in more detail, there's one topic that I need to set up as well, and that is understanding who can access the portal or can access the storage account where we're copying the information
true.
To.
True, we never really talked about that, did
correct.
We?
Correct. I only showed at some point by copying a URL for a VHD that you cannot access it by just putting it in the browser.
Yeah, yeah.
And to summarize all that, this slide lists the four different ways that access control is arranged in anything related to Windows Azure, not counting your VPN story from the previous session, not the networking aspect. So for completeness, here are the four different ways that access and authentication is arranged. The one we've been using all day is accessing the portal. If you do that, you go to manage.windowsazure.com and then you log on with a live ID or a Microsoft account, I should say. Mm-hmm. And after you've logged on, you can control everything in the portal. And what subscriptions can you control? Well, that's determined by the service administrators and the co-administrators. I will show that in a second when I switch to do the demo.
Okay.
Then there's a separate way of granting access, and that is related to so-called certificate of management certificates. Those are not used by the portal. If you just connect to the portal, then you use your Live ID or your Microsoft account. I keep saying it incorrectly. But those certificates are used when you either connect to a subscription by PowerShell or you use the REST APIs. The REST APIs is a web-based method of calling, using HTTP and HTTPS, calling into Azure and configuring it.
Okay.
For that, you need a management certificate. And the third option is related to storage. There is a separate mechanism to allow access to the storage account. You can grant everybody access, that's called anonymous access.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you have lots of interesting PowerPoint presentations and you want to make them available, then of course you can create a website and have them available to the website. But you can also just have a storage account and provide the URL and give anonymous access to everybody to download from there. And the second option is to use a secret key. All keys are probably secret, but this is a secret key.
A super secret key.
Super secret key. And if you have the key, then with that key, which is a long number, you can also, with PowerShell and with the REST APIs, you can access the storage accounts. The fourth one we talked about already, that is just for the end users. If they need to have access to a virtual machine, that's totally separate from the whole Azure story, and that's just a username and password.
Oh, right, of course.
So to summarize, let's say you want to give somebody access to doing something with your subscription. Then basically there are two ways of doing that. You either make them administrator in the portal, and then they have to log on with their live ID, or you add a certificate where they would have the private key, and that means they cannot use the portal, but they can use PowerShell and the REST APIs to connect up.
Also, it just totally depends on how you want to connect into Azure and do whatever you're doing,
yes.
And that dictates it. Okay.
You could also say differently that for PowerShell access control and for REST API access control, your live ID or Microsoft account is not used, right? Because that's
right.
Another way of saying it. And then for storage, something totally different is used. We'll see this used in PowerShell, so that's why I want to point this out.
Okay.
Let me switch to the portal and show you where all these three things are configured. Let me close the PowerPoint, go to the portal. And while I'm logged on, you believe
yeah.
That's here you see in the top.
I've seen
that's
you logged on, yeah.
Logged on, that works. And then if you go to settings, all the way at the bottom, there's a list of administrators. And basically here you can specify who else can log onto the portal and has access to everything you do in your subscription. You just click add, and then you add the live ID, or, well, it's called an email address here.
Okay.
And you add it to the subscription, and from that moment on, that person, if they log on to the portal, will have an additional thing to select from here. So
okay, yes.
This is me, of course. Why am I listed three other times? Because apparently somebody else, namely those three,
gave you
added
rights
me
to
as co-administrator
oh, okay.
there.
Okay, all right. So somebody else does that, and then all of a sudden it just sort of shows up because that's your log-on.
Yes,
and
yes.
They don't say, hey, would you like access? They could just like
it
give
just
you...
It just shows up there, yes.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Okay.
If no one does that for you...
Mm-hmm. Oh, then you don't get any of those choices.
Then you don't get the subscription selection there.
Okay.
But as soon... And just as a demonstration, if I select more subscriptions here and now refresh the page, you will see that I think I added you to this list as well.
You did, yeah. I just if didn't I roll actually notice to, how you did it. So
if I right. roll back to settings and administrators. So on the Versoft MSDN, I'm the only one. But on this particular subscription that I have, I've added you and somebody else here, apparently,
right.
with that beautiful name. So all those people would be administrators as well.
Okay.
So all the ones that you add are co-administrators. And the person that, well, you could almost say pays for the subscription, is the service administrator.
Okay.
What is the difference between a co-administrator and a service administrator? Well, one thing, the co-administrator, in case you wondered, cannot remove a service administrator.
Can I add other people?
Yeah, you can.
Oh.
And you can also,
wow.
I think you can.
I don't know.
And you can definitely delete other people, except not the service administrator.
Okay.
So that was the first one I want to point out. It's a combination of logging in as a live ID. So don't remove me.
I'm not removing you. I just want to see if it works.
And, the live ID and adding as administrator. The second one on the slide, if you can still remember, was related to certificates. That's on the same part with settings, and here is a list of management certificates. Let me filter this down a little bit again. So I'm just removing the Azure IT Camp, so I just have one subscription left. And then you see all the certificates that are loaded here. And again, certificates indicate related private keys of those certificates, those people that have that on the computer, they can use REST APIs or PowerShell to control everything in the subscription as well. Currently, there are three certificates. Pay attention to that, because later in the demo, this will jump to four certificates, and you will see why that is happening.
Okay.
But currently there are three certificates here that can do that.
And those are different certificates completely than what I was talking about earlier with the VPN certificates.
No, they're very similar.
Similar? Okay.
Namely, that this is just a certificate and not a private key. The private key is on the user's computer.
Yeah, and this is but it's a very similar concept than you're
similar
doing.
Concept.
Okay, okay.
And another interesting concept here, if you have these certificates, that there are no rules with regards to expiration or trustworthiness anything like that.
So we're not...
If you do anything with certificates, then you've usually, if you talk about certificates, they're being used to prove somebody's identity. If I go to hotmail.com and I use HTTPS, then I know I'm connecting to a Microsoft property because Microsoft proves with the certificate.
Oh, of course.
So that's a server identification proof. But this is the opposite. We're not proving that we're really connecting to Azure. It's the other way around. The user has to prove that he is who he is and has the private key of the certificate. So this is called a client certificate. And that's why it's different from web server certificates, which what people are much more used
to. Yes, exactly. And you can do a self-signed for this?
You can do self-signed. It doesn't have to be trusted by Azure or anybody.
It's just create it.
It can be already expired. I'm not sure when these are expired. Can I find out? Well, yeah, look at that.
Oh,
the top one
right
is already expired.
Yeah.
This one expires in a year from now. And the last one I went overboard with, I granted myself 25 years of access.
Well, your coffee stuff is going to
be
a
long
for 30, session. So this is going to be a lot of stuff going on. Oh, by the way, I can add other people to the subscription as a co-administrator.
You can.
I can. I didn't, but I can.
Okay,
yes.
That's good. Thanks for the restraint. So you'll see more certificates show up here. The third access that we talked about was related to storage accounts.
Right.
So that's different. If I go to storage, remember earlier we looked at the containers in a storage account in a previous session. And if we copied a particular URL of one of the VHDs and tried it in the browser, it didn't work. What we could do, which I'm not going to do, if I go to, if I go to the storage account and click on, if I go to the container, let's say this particular container, and then I can edit this particular container, and one of the things I can edit on the container, remember the container was the one level subdirectory, right?
Right, yeah.
So I have a container with the name MVA and I can change access to it being a public container, meaning that from that moment on, indeed you could copy the VHD file in the browser and it would actually download the VHD file. That's not something that you should do.
No.
I sometimes do it just for quick, easy access.
Because nobody knows you've got it out there.
Nobody knows it, and then I correct it again. But this is the fact that this was set to private by default blocks that access.
Gotcha.
If you are using PowerShell or REST APIs and want to deal with access to multiple storage accounts, then in those PowerShell commands or in those REST API commands, you can use a secret key, and each of the storage account has two secret keys that you can use to that, use for that. So anybody that knows these secret access keys can then access the accounts, everything in the storage account. So this is separate from anonymous access. This is actually allowing you access to everything that's in there.
Okay.
So if I give a key to somebody, they can use it for a while, and then if I click regenerate,
then they can't use it for a while. It's done.
Invalidate that key.
Oh, okay. Do you just like email them the key and then they copy it and do something with it, or what do they do?
I haven't been granting out access very often.
Hypothetically, what you would do, you'd have to give them that key,
and give them the key.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Or you could also
maybe
have an application that uses this key, right?
Where
it's built in or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
This user interface is actually very friendly for demos because the key is longer than you see here. So that's why I can easily show it on the screen, because you still don't know the remaining 80 characters, or however many characters
that looks
are there.
Like somebody's wireless access point key, really. No,
just kidding. Yeah, for super secure.
Yeah, super secure.
So those are the ways you can get access with either certificates or with the private keys, with those secret keys, access keys, if you use PowerShell or the REST APIs.
I didn't know you could lock it down that way. That's kind of neat. I mean, because it's locked down by default, right?
Yes, yeah. It's locked down already. You can open it up like that.
Wow. Let's
go back to the presentation. And we're going to see this working, of course, if I go to the next slide. Because now we're going to talk about how to upload your own VHD file. It's actually very easy to do. It's a very simple command. But I also make use of the opportunity now to explain how you can get PowerShell to work with connecting to a subscription. And listening to the previous story, that has a lot to do with making sure that the certificate is in place so you can indeed connect to the subscription. If you have set up the access correctly, then the last part, actually executing the add Azure VHD command, is not the most difficult one. The most difficult one where you have to focus on is how to grant access to the PowerShell command.
Oh, wow.
And I will do that. So we're going to upload a VHD file from Hyper-V to Azure, meaning that the VHD file is most likely a virtual machine that runs on Hyper-V, and now I want to run it in Azure.
Oh, so one of those, is it show up as an image, or is it just, it's a VHD file? Where does it go? I guess I'll see it when you do it.
That's a very good question. And all three options, VHD, disk, and image, exist. So I'm using the add Azure VHD command. If you look at the bottom, now you know what the difference is.
Oh, no, I didn't even look.
That is different from add Azure disk or add Azure image. Of course, I'm not going to explain it now because it was in the previous session.
Right,
But those are indeed the three different options. So yes, you can do that, what you just said.
I could read that page and look at it right there.
That works as well.
Amazing.
What do you need to watch out for if you take a VHD from Hyper-V and want to run it in Azure? There's only one thing that probably is important here, and that is that with Hyper-V, you have so-called console access, meaning that even if you have no username and password, you can still look at a booting or starting virtual machine, and then you can log on, etc.
Yeah.
And you, in Hyper-V, you never have to make an RDP connection or a terminal server connection to terminal services running inside the virtual machine.
Really?
Really. That's what the Hyper-V manager allows you to do.
Okay.
So another way of saying that is if you have a Hyper-V virtual machine and you restart the Hyper-V virtual machine, you can continue to look at the booting process, right? You see it shutting down.
You see it.
You see it come up.
Okay.
And then you see it starting up. And clearly, that's not connecting to the terminal server because that's rebooting as well, right?
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
But that's Hyper-V.
Right.
And in Azure, you have to connect to terminal servers.
Okay.
So if in your virtual machine you have blocked RDP access, you have no way of getting to that virtual machine. So what you should do in Hyper-V before you, let's say, close the VHD file that you're going to load up, is make sure that RDP access is allowed.
Oh, in the virtual machine itself?
In the virtual machine.
Oh, so this isn't like the settings for the port or anything like that. This is actually in the VM.
This is actually in the Windows configuration.
The Windows configuration,
So that means probably the firewall needs to be allowing RDP. And there's this setting in Windows that says allow
remote
access or something like that, right? So that's what you need to do.
Yeah.
Contrary to popular belief, you don't have to worry about the IP networking settings. I'm not breaking any rule here, but even if you have a static IP address configured for your virtual machine in Hyper-V, if you upload it to Windows Azure and it loads as a running virtual machine, it gets a new network quit. Equivalent to a new network adapter anyway, and by default any new network adapter will get DHCP anyway.
Okay.
So don't worry about removing the static or fixed, static IPconf creation in Hyper-V. That's not needed.
Okay, so step you don't have to worry about.
Correct. I'm calling it out because I see sometimes references that you have to do that.
I see that a lot, yeah.
But that's not needed.
Okay.
What I do myself, but that's just because I want to make it neat, since I know that in Windows Azure the page file is on the D drive, that's actually what I do in Hyper-V now as well, place the page file on the D drive. So if I go back and forth,
then
it stays
very
exactly
clean.
The same.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So otherwise, if you don't do that, the page file in Hyper-V, in Azure, will be on the C drive.
Oh, and then you're uploading the page file, so you have to...
And then the page file just goes to the storage blob, and you're not making use of that performance.
That doesn't make any sense to do, right.
I call it optional. It's more like a nice tip to use.
Yeah.
Another thing to point out is that before this PowerShell command existed, there was a command line tool that you could download in the Azure SDK, I think. And it's called csupload.exe. CS stands for Cloud Service. Don't use it anymore.
Okay.
The PowerShell is the replacement, let's say. And this PowerShell command is actually pretty smart because it will convert dynamically expanding VHD files to static. So you don't have to... I actually used the wrong terminology here. It's called a fixed VHD file.
Okay.
So from dynamic to fixed.
I would just change it.
If nobody is looking. So I don't think anybody noticed that in the recording.
It was very
so
slick.
If you convert from dynamic to fixed, some people call it static, that's incorrect, it's called fixed. And the second smart thing it does is it uploads sparse, meaning that if you have 0 bytes, bytes that have the value of zero, it does not upload it. So a really large file can upload really quickly.
Okay.
So okay, let's see that happening. I will switch to... I'm switching now to a RDP connection.
Okay.
What represents an on-premise situation with Hyper-V.
Okay.
So I was wondering, how can I now get a RDP connection to a virtual machine? I'm cheating here a little bit, because what I'm doing is I am using one of the Azure virtual machines.
Oh, it's on your desktop?
No, I'm already connected to it now.
Oh, okay.
But so don't look at that part. Just
I won't
pretend
look at that part.
This is just normal Hyper-V running here, and I'm just now RDPing into that machine.
Right.
And from here, I will upload a VHD file that I created. I actually created already a VHD file. To not make it take too long, I have in the disks folder, I've created a very small VHD file.
Okay. Other than, you had a small VHD before, now it's a very small
VHD. This is a very small VHD file. It's called smalldisk2.vhd.
Okay.
This is a dynamically expanding VHD file. And if we go to inspect disk and look at it, you can actually see that it's a 2 gigabyte dynamically expanding VHD file, except that I didn't put anything there. So it's empty,
so
that's why it's
right.
6K. So that just, it's more for the example. So now I have to do two things. Actually, I have to do three things. I have to install PowerShell for Windows Azure.
Okay.
I have to make sure that PowerShell connects correctly to my subscription. And then I have to give the command to upload. Well, the first one, installing PowerShell for Windows Azure, I already did. I went to the windowsazure.com download location, and here at the bottom you can see the Windows Azure PowerShell with the latest update from November 2013.
Oh, and they just keep updating the version because they'll have different tools, of course.
Exactly, yeah. And I want to point out that indeed the version is important. I think even in the previous session you mentioned something with new things in networking that may come out, which means an update to Windows Azure
Absolutely,
PowerShell.
Yeah.
So then here it would probably say last updated February 2013 or something. 2014,
right, exactly.
Something.
Yeah.
So I installed the latest version as of today. So that's already installed. And that means that Windows Azure PowerShell is already there. And now the next thing I have to do is making sure that we can connect to the subscription correctly and have the right permissions.
And is this where you need a certificate to do
this
it?
This is where you need a certificate. I have commands here next to me, so I will type the commands from here if I look on the site. That's because I'm looking at the commands. I have the PowerShell window already open, And I already did it to test everything, but I will just do the exact same steps again.
Okay.
First, what we need to do is have a certificate loaded that we can use. There are two options for that. You can create a certificate like you did with mm-hmm. MakeCert, and then use that certificate, copy, load it in the local machine, and load it up into Windows Azure. However, there is also a different command, and that's the command cat azure publish settings.
Oh, it fills it in for you. Like you just start.
Before I do that, let me make sure we're not cheating, and I'm deleting the previous test that I did to make sure everything works.
Okay.
So if you, I'll go back. If you have Windows Azure PowerShell open, mm-hmm. very conveniently tap completion. Pressing tab and completing a command works really nice. So cat azure publish shh. There's only one command that fits that, and that settings also.
So it's
then
just
you can
sort
do
of guesses.
That.
Okay.
What it does now is actually pretty smart. If I hit enter now, mm-hmm. it opens up a new website, asks me to log on with my live ID, generates a certificate, prompts the certificate to be downloaded.
Really?
And then automatically installs it on my client computer.
So you don't have to do anything? Because
don't have to do anything complicated. And in fact, if you don't understand certificates so well, you will not understand certificates better after this command because it's all underwater, so you don't know what happens. So that's why I want to explain it. So I hit enter. I go to a different website.
Okay.
The website asks me to, Windows Azure website, of course.
Of course.
Ask me to log on. Let me log on with my super secret password. That I will do here.
It's all dots.
The same password I use everywhere.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. I hope that typed the dots correctly. Okay. So now I get to this special page, and it tells me, okay, which subscription do you want to have the certificate for? Well, that is this one. And then I click submit, and that would create a certificate, load it in Windows Azure, and at the same time give me a downloadable file that I can now save and use on the PowerShell site.
Wow.
So you really don't have to do anything complicated with MakeCert or even understand what's
I'm
happening.
I'm jealous.
To
that,
be frankly.
That's very cool.
I'm sure they can talk to each other and do something similar like this. So I'm going to save this. I'm saving it in the tools folder, and I'm going to call it CertPub1, just any name so we can recognize it easily a little bit later. Save, and that's done. I close this, and I can close the website. And this is really a small file. Remember, I had opened it already. It's a small file, just 8K, and it has the extension publish settings, and that's what
that's
we saved there.
Of course,
right?
Okay.
Okay, so that was just one very powerful command. Now, the next command I have to do is, I'm in PowerShell, say import this Azure publish settings file. And which file is it? Well, I can tell you which it is, because I put it in C tools, and then this one. Tab completion works here as well, so I'm importing this one. Import, 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 and that's done already. So that means that this time the private key is already loaded on this computer. And at the same time, if I now switch back, let me close this. If I switch back to the portal, because I still have the portal open,
right,
and go to the settings, then you will see here in management certificates, it used to be 3 certificates.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see, it's now 4 certificates. Well, I'm talking a little bit faster
than
the portal.
You're talking faster than the portal's talking,
yeah,
but it will be 4 certificates.
Let me press F5 and then...
The portal's thinking it over.
The portal
didn't
realize that I suddenly had an extra certificate.
There we go, yeah.
But here you see it. So I have 2 of them, right? I did one this morning and for testing, and there's the other one.
Right.
So 2 different certificates. They just happen to have the same name because it's the same date. So very easy to do that compared to using a MakeCert certificate,
right,
etc.
And I thought MakeCert was pretty easy, but this is just like click, click,
it takes
done.
More time to explain everything than actually do
I
the commands.
I think so, right? Yeah.
So let's go back here. So at this moment, I can connect 2 subscriptions already. What it also did is it set the subscription as the default subscription. That means in PowerShell terms that any command that I now give towards a subscription mm-hmm. will be, I don't have to specify what subscription it is, it will just know that is the subscription it uses.
Oh, cool.
There's a command called cat Azure subscriptions, and it will actually list all the subscriptions that it knows about. So if you have multiple subscriptions, you can actually change from one subscription to another and indicate what the default is. Here you can see this particular subscription is default yes, so it will use that one if I don't say anything, if I don't change it. And another subscription, this one for example, is default false. No.
Okay.
So it knows about it, it just PowerShell just now does not know it. The other thing I have to do is...
Is it sort of like changing subscriptions then in the portal when you're working on things too? Because you can select which subscription you want to work
yes,
on at the time.
Very
so it's
similar.
A very, very
yes,
same.
Yes.
Okay.
So in the portal you have a filter of what you want to look at.
Yeah, you just check the checkboxes and check, yeah.
And here you specify what your default subscription is in all the PowerShell
Makes
commands that you do.
Makes perfect sense.
So another thing you need to specify is which storage account you want to store the information. So both there's a default subscription and then there's a default storage account. The way you do that is that you say set Azure subscriptions, if I say it correctly, and then I have to specify the subscription name because I'm going to change one of the subscriptions here that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And the name is, if I type it correctly, Fursoft MSDN. That's one of the subscriptions I have there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say that the current storage account name is, from all the storage accounts I have, is this particular one. Remember, I had 5 or 6 storage accounts.
You had quite a few, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll do that. So now this one is set. I already did it earlier already, and you can see here the current storage account name is Fursoft.
Okay.
That means that if I now give any PowerShell commands, Windows Azure PowerShell commands, by default, they go against that subscription, and by default, they go against this storage account. So
now
I can copy things to that account.
So you're just being very specific where it's going and what,
Yes, indeed. Okay. So let's recap what we're trying to do. I have this disk of 2 gigabytes,
mm-hmm.
well, it's dynamically expanding, that I want to upload to the portal, to Windows Azure, I should say.
Yes.
And then it shows up in the portal. Where I want to put it is actually in the Fursoft storage,
mm-hmm.
and then in the container named MVA. There's currently one file there that I uploaded this morning at 4:44, apparently. And now I will copy another. This is like different time zone.
Now it's being impressive. 4:44,
now I will upload the other one that's called Small Disk 2. So let's go to here. And what is the command to upload? Well, the command is add Azure VHD. What I need to specify, I specify a source VHD. In a PowerShell, anything that starts with a dollar sign means it's a parameter, a variable. So the source is C disks small disk. That is the source. Did I type it correctly? Probably. And the destination, VHD, is http versoft.blob.core. Windows.net. Remember, this is the way you specify a storage account URL.
Yes.
Then the container is MVA. And then within the container, the VHD name is smalldisk2.vhd. That's the name that
I will
use.
You have that all memorized. You have that all memorized?
I have that all on the paper next to me. So that's the, I'll put it in a quote for good practice. So those are two variables that I define.
Okay.
And now the command to upload it is literally as simple as add Azure VHD. And then it takes one parameter, which is the local file path. And that is this one that I already created, or the variable.
Right.
And then it takes another parameter, which is the destination. And that takes the other, not that one, that takes
that
the
one,
other
yeah.
one. And what it does now under the covers is actually pretty complicated, because what it does, it uses the certificate. It looks at the default subscription and default storage. Then it looks at the certificate, uses the certificate to access the secret access key for the storage, and then uses that to grant itself access to writing at that location.
That's pretty fancy.
So compared to doing it manually, for sure.
Yeah.
So this command is very easy. So if I now hit enter, then it will do all that, get the access key. Now it has the access key. It's going to calculate the hash of the file. Notice that the file is 2000 megabytes. It has made it large already.
Mm-hmm.
And now it uploaded the file. It expanded it to 2 gigabytes.
That's the whole time for the upload? Like it's done now?
Yes, because it does two things. It automatically expands it to fixed size. And then everything that's zero, it's not going to send it. So it was really only sending 6K. So that's why it could,
okay,
could do it so quickly. So I was not trying to trick you.
I was,
just
I was
how
sort of
smart
like, wow,
it is.
Yeah, that's
if I go to the portal,
brilliant,
then you see the file being here. I probably have to like go back
refresh
and forth
about,
again.
Yeah.
To, yeah. I'm too
that
quick
was
here.
Faster than the portal.
Yeah, here,
yeah,
there it is.
There we
uploaded
go.
At 346, which is now. And notice the size of the file. Do we have the size anywhere? Oh, sorry, I made it to, there
oh,
it is.
Oh, there we go, right.
The size is 2 gigabytes.
So it expands again?
It expanded as a fixed size. From
okay,
this moment, this is a VHD, so now I can connect a disk, can load it in a virtual machine, and can use it like that.
Oh, so cool. That How was
do
really
I do
reverse?
Fast. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Well, this was a small file to begin with.
But still,
with, right?
I mean, yeah, it wasn't like, you know, come back a half an hour, you know?
Yeah,
really
exactly.
Good.
Now, let's say I want to do the reverse. I have been using this VHD file in Windows Azure for quite some time. I'm happy with it, but now I want to have it back in
right,
back at Hyper-V. How do I do that? Two ways to do it. One would be staying on this page, actually, and noticing the download button at the bottom. I can just select the file and say download, and says, sure, we will download it. Do you want to download this file? And I just say save as, and then it just saves the VHD. So this is to the browser.
Wow.
I never do this, by the way, but this
but
is a quick
could,
way
yeah,
to do it. Cancel. So, and close this one. But you can also use, again, PowerShell with the exact command what you would assume how it would work. Namely, very similar to the add Azure VHD. The command is save Azure VHD. So that is the other way around, from Azure to local. It takes two parameters. One is the source parameter, which is the destination VHD,
yeah,
remember? Because that's where
to flip
it's coming
it
from.
Yeah, yeah.
And the local file is, local file path is where I will store it, and that yeah, is the source VHD. Notice I'm using the same parameters,
you're just
so that was a little
around,
bit confusing.
Of course. Yeah.
So now it wants to overwrite the existing file. Remember, we have the existing file here. If I don't specify the override button, sorry, the override command,
mm-hmm,
it's actually going to tell me, well, probably not, because you have no override option.
I see.
I probably don't want to override it. If I rename this one, this was the original, remember?
Mm-hmm.
If I rename it, and now the file name doesn't exist anymore, if I now try it again, then you will see that it's now downloading a 2 gigabyte file.
It's not yelled
file
at you yet, so that's good.
Well, and you
yeah,
see that it's here downloading it with 2
mm-hmm,
gigabyte. Now it's not doing anything smart because it's now having to download
it's just
all
downloading
the
all that stuff.
2 gigabyte.
But that's just really very cool.
Yeah, and this takes about 4 minutes, so I'll just let this run and then it has this downloaded here.
So, like that, so this is the one that takes a long time, is the 4 minutes. Seriously.
To
download this. This is crazy.
Longer than the
yeah, but
the
I mean,
upload.
That's still so fast, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So those, let's switch back to the presentation. So those were the two commands. Well, this was the add Azure VHD command to copy a VHD file to Azure and then use it. And similarly, the save one is to get it back again.
Right.
So one more thought. Let's say I had a running VHD in Windows in Hyper-V.
Mm-hmm.
I closed it down. I upload it to Azure. Get a new network adapter. Get a dynamic IP address from your virtual network. Using it there for a while. The old network adapter is still in the VHD, of course, configured, but it's not being used. And if I now download it again and load it in Hyper-V, then it will recognize the old network adapter and has its static IP settings back.
So it just kind of hangs on to those.
It just hangs.
So
hangs
is
there.
That maybe you just whenever it comes back, as long as you're putting it back where it came from, that's a good idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then if you literally put it back there, it recognizes it again.
Right.
You probably recognize sometimes if you configure a network adapter in a virtual machine, and then sometimes it says, "Hey, this IP address already exists on a non." Present adapter, and that's
it stays
a non-present adapter. This was actually the last slide from this presentation deck. So I think this also means we're getting to the end of the whole day.
We are.
So let's make sure to tell everybody thank you very much for attending.
Yes, thank
if you.
Yeah.
Attended all the six sessions, and I also want to encourage you to take the poll. That is at the end of the video. So we're always interested in finding out what you like, what you don't like, and how we could make this even more attractive for you. So please fill out the poll. And with that, I think we can end the last session. So
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.